On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan nearly 30 years ago set in motion events that live in our headlines today. The war-torn nation that hosted the planners of 9/11, lived through the brutal Taliban regime, and then a U.S. invasion, is far from stable now, even with its supposedly pro-U.S. government. Reporter, activist, entrepreneur Sarah Chase has lived both the breathtaking promise and the stalled promises of the new Afghanistan. With an unmatched perspective, she has seen at ground level what has been done there and how much is left to do. This hour, On Point, award-winning journalist Sarah Chase's journey to find and tell the truth about one of the most beautiful, frustrating, and violent places on Earth. First, we go to Kabul for an update on the continued fighting in Afghanistan, where today NATO reported the killing of 11 Taliban insurgents in southern Afghanistan who residents say were civilians. Rachel Moarji is Afghanistan correspondent for the Financial Times. She joins us from Kabul. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, John.
Rachel, describe, I mean, it seems as though the insurgency in Afghanistan is gaining a kind of momentum that is really out of scale of the U.S. military presence and maybe beyond their control. What do you think?
I think certainly what we're seeing is a reinvigorated, regrouped, and refunded Taliban. No one really knows where the money's coming from, but if you do the math, the Afghan National Army are being paid $4 a day to deploy into the field. Taliban fighters in southern Afghanistan are getting over $12 a day. Whether this money's coming from drug barons, criminals, or over the border from Pakistan and being funded from militant groups overseas is hard to say. But certainly it's stretching both the resources of NATO, the U.S., and the Afghan government to their absolute limit, if not beyond them.
Do you sense a strategic element to this? Is the insurgency attacking particular targets, trying to gain territory? And is the NATO force attempting to protect civilians or mostly protect themselves?
The Taliban have definitely focused on southern Afghanistan. They've spied an opportunity to break the will of political will of NATO nations back home. In April, the Canadian deployment only passed in the parliament by 4 votes. It was a very narrow margin. And so while the east of Afghanistan was the focus for the fighting last year, the south has taken the brunt of it this year, the area that NATO troops are deployed. But it's certainly true that NATO is spread far too thinly. They went in with a stated mission of reconstruction and development and have found themselves fighting battles in remote towns and have really been able to secure nothing. And British development in Helmand province, where over 2,000 British troops are deployed, amounts to about 2 awnings over a market at this point. And we're seeing hundreds of civilians moving into Lashkargah, which is the main town of Helmand, fleeing the fighting in more remote regions.
Does the Afghan government, such as it is, have any capacity to take development money and funds and resources and deploy them outside of the NATO troops? Or is it just impossible to fight the Taliban like this?
We know that this is not a battle that can be won in purely military terms. But the fighting, the violence has got so bad that it's now becoming very difficult for aid workers to work in the south of Afghanistan. I spoke to one Afghan NGO recently that will pull its operations in Kandahar down to 10 people from 450 at present. They're going to wind up all of the development programs that they're doing by Christmas because they just don't feel it's safe enough to operate there anymore. This is going to make it very difficult in the next year for NATO to attract more NGOs into that region.
Hmm. Well, Rachel Moarji, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, John.
Rachel is Afghanistan correspondent for the Financial Times. She joined us from Kabul. We're talking this hour about Afghanistan and how to restore order in a traumatized nation caught in a cycle of bloody violence for nearly 3 decades. And we're talking this hour with former NPR reporter Sarah Chase. She put down her microphone in 2002 to run a nonprofit with the brother of President Hamid Karzai. and still lives there today. Her new book is The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban Fell. Sarah Chase, welcome to the On Point Studios.
Delighted to be here.
Welcome back, I should say. Congratulations on the publication of The Punishment of Virtue.
Thank you very much.
It's a terrific reporting job and certainly answers a lot of questions about what went on, the details of what went on in Afghanistan. You describe in this book, and I want your view of the contemporary scene as well, just how difficult it is in the moment to give any sort of assessment of what's going on. And you use your own experience of, you know, the war actually transpired very, very differently than you reported and others reported because of the impossibility of seeing the big picture. Do you think that is plaguing our understanding of what's going on in Afghanistan right now?
Absolutely. It's the big picture, and it's also the details of the picture. What I've really come to understand by having been there over a number of years is the importance of particular local knowledge, that you can't simply take a model and apply it, you know, from one country to another or even one region to another in a place like Afghanistan. It's really important when intervening abroad to acquire knowledge about the players, about their histories, about their relationships with each other. And that's been one of the real failings that I've seen in the international intervention in Afghanistan has been the acquisition and transmission of knowledge.
You know, and all those details tend to be really telling, and I think your book contains an enormous number of details that suddenly extrapolate to show just how difficult the situation is. I mean, even Rachel talking to us from Kabul, the simple detail of the Taliban are getting $12 a day, the Afghan NATO-paid forces are getting $4 a day. I don't think I've seen that detail anywhere, and it speaks volumes.
Absolutely.
So how do you figure the Afghanistan government being able to withstand what's coming from the Taliban insurgency right now?
You know, this to me, I see this insurgency as being a kind of result of two forces. One force is that it's actually not an indigenous insurgency. I don't experience it that way. I experience it as people who really are fundamentally trained, organized, equipped, and paid across the border in Pakistan, largely with some help, increasing help from Iranian authorities. But what it is taking advantage of is a desperate and completely widespread disillusionment with the Afghan government. And what's been very interesting, because I was there reporting from, you know, 2 days after the Taliban fell, the excitement, the enthusiasm, the just joy, even in Kandahar, at this new experiment in creating a new nation state was so vibrant. And to have lost that is a real tragedy. And so what's happening is, Rachel said that this is not a problem that can be solved militarily. I think it's not only the issue of can NGOs get out there and do development work, it's will the government or the government as people experience it on a day-to-day level, will it treat them like citizens? I mean, what I've seen, every day you drive around Kandahar, you see a piece of abuse perpetrated by a member of the government, a police officer or a soldier or a bank official, you know, and a national bank official or a civil servant, a piece of abuse perpetrated against an ordinary citizen. And so that's, I think, why people have separated themselves from this government and begin to give some breathing room.
Well, you have to wonder what the perspective is of a average Afghan citizen right now, seeing the Taliban being paid from resources inside Pakistan, yet Pakistan is an ally of the United States. The United States is the ally of the Afghan government. Who reports to whom? What are the consequences of that level of confusion about who's running the show here?
Well, the result in terms of ordinary Afghans and what they think, everybody in Kandahar, bar none, believes, or maybe bar a handful, believes that the United States is in alliance with the Taliban. That's what people believe.
Astonishing.
And that's one of the reasons they're upset at America. I mean, it's this incredible irony that Kandaharis are not upset at the United States for its Western and Christian culture, but because it seems to them to be supporting a fundamentalist Islamist movement.
Now, is that a kind of an urban legend kind of myth that you find on the ground in Afghanistan, like, you know, there were no Jews in the World Trade Center kind of thing? Or is that something that is a really rational response to the realities they see?
Well, you set it up when you asked me the question. They remember back in the anti-Soviet jihad that the United States was supporting the anti-Soviet resistance groups via Pakistan, mm-hmm. that support very rarely went directly to the groups. So they see, you know, the United States provides $2.5 billion to Pakistan over a five-year period, and then they see Pakistan creating essentially the Taliban insurgency, so they assume that it's deliberate.
So really, really great spin control on the part of the U.S. administration, at least in terms of trying to win the hearts and minds of the Afghans.
Absolutely, absolutely.
First of all, you know, let's get a feel for what is in this book here. And I want to ask you to read a detail that is so interesting to me, because I think this book is filled with details that you find of life in Afghanistan that you can draw really interesting global conclusions about, that speak volumes about what's going on in Afghanistan these days. Tell me about the night ferries, if you would.
This actually is something that happened after the end of the book, so this particular passage isn't in the book, but I'm reading from an article that came out in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists this past spring.
Mm-hmm.
Last fall, an elderly gentleman came by my house on a dirt street near the Kandahar Bazaar. His eyes were a little roomier than I remembered, his white beard wispier. A shawl was draped across the top of his turban and around his shoulders to protect against the autumn chill. He's the village elder of a hamlet I used to visit regularly, located in a tangle of pomegranate orchards just beyond a line of rocky hills that looks like the crenellated back of a dinosaur. The dairy cooperative I was running then used to collect milk there every morning, 2 liters from one family, 5 from another, carried to our truck by children and oldsters in a riot of receptacles. Now, in fulfillment of a year-old promise, I wanted to buy pomegranates from this village. I apologized to the old man for sending my staff to fetch him. "I didn't want to come see you myself," I said, "for fear of causing you trouble." No, he answered, with a frank smile. "I wouldn't have given you permission to come." This is the second Kandahar area farmer who's broken with the deep-rooted local tradition of hospitality, as well as the lure of a higher price for his produce, and asked me not to approach his village for fear of retaliation once I leave. Even more than the frequent explosions aimed at U.S. or Canadian military convoys, the ambushes and the murders in mass, these polite refusals of concrete assistance by struggling villagers signal how far the security situation has deteriorated in the past year.
You know, that's a fascinating detail. He has to come to you for you to interact with him. You cannot come to him. You describe so eloquently in your book and in your reporting of this elaborate ritual of hospitality in Afghanistan that I've witnessed myself being there, and that there's now a counter-ritual of anti-hospitality that is motivated out of this fear and destabilization going on in the country. I mean, that's really tragic.
It's tragic, and to me, it almost starts to signal a tipping point, and that's why I wanted to write about it in this article. And this happened, you know, just about a year ago. So although we're talking about an upsurge in the insurgency, the signs were totally evident already a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem there is, Rachel mentioned the difficulty for foreign NGOs to visit their Afghan beneficiaries. What I experience here, and it's not only this example, there are several examples, and it's a pattern now, is that the beneficiaries don't want to be helped anymore. And that's why that's such a tragedy and a dangerous situation, because then how do you go about trying to turn it around?
Now, in this place, and you write about this in The Punishment of Virtue, you decided, after being a reporter there, to shed your microphone, to shed the reportorial detachment, and to vanish, in a sense, inside Afghan society as best you could. Why did you decide to do that?
I think that it was actually a dissatisfaction that had been growing in me already, even before 9/11, with the indirectness of reporting. In other words, was I really having an impact on something? Of course, the media has an enormous impact on public policy, but when you're out there, as I'm sure you remember, sometimes it feels a little bit indirect. What effect is the effort that I am taking having?
Now, is the directness because you personally need to be making a direct impact every day to feel good about what you're doing, or is the direct impact something that you think is important because journalism doesn't add up?
I think those are separate questions, and I think both of them may be true. I think that I really felt the need to get my hands dirty, as it were. And the other major issue is one of continuity. What I was starting to experience reporting, and especially being one of these smoke jumper types, you know, is you go in, you almost merge with a story. You're taking it on so almost organically. And then suddenly you're pulled out and you're sent to some other country, mm-hmm. and you suddenly have to take in the cast of characters again, try to understand the context again. And I think I knew that I wasn't getting it, as I found out, mm-hmm. And as is chronicled in Punishment of Virtue, there, you know, as hard as you try and as talented as you may or may not be, I think that just that relationship with time makes it really difficult to come to a useful understanding of the environment that you're in.
Well, you know, that story is told in your book, The Fall of Kandahar. You were there, you witnessed it, you reported one thing, and it took you years, literally, of nailing down what actually happened, and the conclusion that you came to is profoundly disturbing. Quickly tell that story, if you could.
Well, we were not allowed to go into Afghanistan at this point. The Taliban still held Kandahar, and our editors were very concerned about our personal safety and all of that. So it meant that you're reporting on an event from a distance, which always has...
Yeah, you're talking to people walking back out, people going in, people on trucks, random people, and they're telling you, oh, I just saw this, oh, I just saw that.
Exactly. And you have your contacts. You decide, oh, here's my guy who's in the middle of it. I happen to have one of these commanders who was in this anti-Taliban sort of proxy force.
And you got to hope your guys are better than everybody else's guys.
Right. And you have no way, I mean, very little way of independently checking what they're saying. And in this case, I had I had the satellite numbers of commanders in the field, you know, and they're telling me about this huge land battle that's happening between the anti-Taliban proxies and basically Al-Qaeda at the airport right outside Kandahar City. And, you know, as you say, I'm talking to people who are coming out, and what was interesting is it didn't actually quite line up. I never got anybody coming out to tell me about a great big land battle.
Mm-hmm.
But there was such, again, there's a certain conformism in journalism that, you know, if everybody else is reporting this thing and you do have a source who's telling you this, it's really hard to go against it if you don't have kind of proof to the contrary.
So you reported the Battle of the Fall of Kandahar, which turned out to be a battle between who?
The United States and Al-Qaeda. The United States in the air and Al-Qaeda. There were people on the ground. They weren't doing any fighting.
Hmm. Interesting.
Until they reached Kandahar, at which point it became a battle for Kandahar between two different U.S. proxies. And basically what happened was President Karzai and his crowd were north of the city, and another fellow whose name was Gulagha Shirzai and his people were south of the city. And President Karzai appointed a governor for Kandahar, and he said how things were going to happen. And the Special Forces soldiers who were with the other group, this Gulagha Shirzai's group, actually encouraged him to go and take Kandahar militarily from President Karzai and the people that he had appointed to hold the city.
So the U.S. military went with the warlord, and Karzai, also supported by the U.S., was told to stay out of Kandahar?
Basically, I mean, he, of course, went into Kandahar, but his candidate for governor was displaced.
Hmm. And that's had enormous consequences, and I want to talk about that. But describe, you have a family in Afghanistan. I don't mean that you married a mullah or something, right?
Well, I lived in a family when I first arrived.
Right.
Is that the family you're
yeah.
talking about? Yeah. I don't live with them anymore, but that's how I decided to base myself when I was reporting, is rather than going to the kind of hotel where all the journalists hang out, which has its value, as you know, because things, when the journalists cluster, then when there are events, you can share information and things like that. But
they have pens in hotels if you need a pen or batteries. You
know. There's that too, yeah. But there's the exchange of information that often is useful. But again, it also tends to reinforce a kind of unitary vision of what's going on. And I don't know why, but I just decided that's not where I wanted to stay. And I had this contact who was this commander who had told me some fibs. But I asked him, look, can you find me a place to stay? So he comes up with a house, a family of his tribesmen, and he asked them to put me up. So I lived in a family, an extended family, which is how, you know, it works in Afghanistan. So I think there were 22 of us in this mud brick compound in the middle of a cemetery with running water, with electricity and no running water.
And what window do you get from being in a situation like that?
Well, first of all, you experience how people actually live. And so you experience, in this case, how very practical the concerns of most people in southern Afghanistan are. I think we have a tendency from over here, when we talk about Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and things like that, we think of this as a very ideologically driven society. And what I learned straight away is that Kandaharis are really concerned about the very practical concerns of bringing up their families and trying to make a life. So what this family was really interested in, they were enthusiastic about the kind of new regime, and they were enthusiastic because they really wanted to send their children to school, including their little girls. And I ended up actually escorting their little two of the younger daughters in the family to the first day of school in more than 6 years. Mm. They were interested.
A joyous moment.
Totally.
It can be said that perhaps your presence among them was on some level a danger to them.
At that stage, no. Mm-hmm. At that stage, no. And it was an incredibly lucrative event for them. Mm-hmm. So, which I recognized when I came back the next spring and saw that they had added a television, a satellite dish to their roof, and they built an extra room on their house and things like that. So you could see that they had made out from my presence there. But they really were looking, from this government, they were looking for what we are looking to our government for. To a large extent, they wanted, you know, roads that you could drive on. They wanted, you know, medical hospitals and medical clinics staffed by competent people. They wanted schools for their children. They wanted, you know, they weren't driven by an ideological conception of the relationship between their country and ours.
And in some sense, you were driven by, well, if this government isn't going to supply some of these things in some of these places, then I will figure out a way to do it myself.
At that time, I was driven by the belief that the government would be supplying all of these things. I was tremendously inspired by...
So when you started your ventures, your NGO, and the kinds of arrangements that you had to help out people in Afghanistan, you figured you were working with the government.
That's exactly right. Hmm. That's exactly right.
Didn't turn out that way.
It didn't. And it was a tremendous, almost shocking kind of disillusionment when I really... kind of broke through that looking glass.
Let's take a call. Carmen from Fort Drum, New York. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the program. I listen often. I just have a comment. My husband and his unit are stationed in Afghanistan, and I kind of see both sides of it. I know when they first went in, there was no resistance. They, you know, had updates about how well they were doing, and seems like the last few months we've had a lot of skirmishes and we've lost a lot of soldiers in our unit. I know I could tell you one story the commander told us when he came back for one of our to escort one of the bodies back, and he said that one of the, like a mayor or the tribal head, was really wanting to get his village updated and, you know, really was, you know, wanting the U.S. to help, and he ended up being assassinated. So, you know, I see where, you know, there's these intertribal fighting, and then I also see where, you know, our guys are out there really doing, they built a school over there, and, you know, there's just, you know, you can't say either way because there's so many facets, and depending on where you are, and they're really in a secluded area. So.
Carmen, it sounds like with the news of the last few months that I'm sensing a bit of fear in your voice about, you know, what's in store for your husband over the next few months.
I mean, definitely our unit in particular has lost a few guys, and in the few, and it seems like every week. I know, I'm in this unit, and I know a lot of the people, and it just really is starting to get scary. I was told that it's going to be a safer assignment in Afghanistan. So, and when our unit has been hit so hard in the last few weeks, it just seems like maybe, you know, maybe not. And why are they still there, you know?
Wow.
So.
Well, Carmen, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. You guys have a great day.
Sure. You're going back, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to make it sound like there isn't an insurgency out there. That's not what I'm saying at all. There is. I might not call it an insurgency, as mm-hmm. I say, because I don't think that it's really supported. It has a kind of broad-based ideological support that you expect of an insurgency, but it is definitely happening, and it is definitely a lot more violent out there than it was, you know, 6 months ago. But the other thing is...
And I ask again, you're going back, right? You're going back into this.
Yeah, I'm going back into this if Kandahar doesn't fall between now and November, which is when I'm planning to go back. I mean, you know, I'm going in if it's physically possible for me to go back. But
not as a reporter.
No.
To
no.
work with your Michael, company that's trying
right.
to
make soap,
make soap instead of heroin.
Right, exactly. So we're it's a little cooperative. We're eight people. I'm going to add three when I go back because we have too much demand for what we're producing. But
I mean, I don't know whether to give you the Nobel Peace Prize or to handcuff you to that chair.
It's totally irrational. You're absolutely right, because there's like this split screen where what we're doing is really successful and exciting. I mean, it's botany and it's, you know, vegetable dyes that we're finding up in the hills, and wild almonds and pistachios and all of this stuff that we're making soap out of that is this dynamite soap. I mean, soap is soap, right? But I've got people telling me I'm addicted to your soap.
Sarah Chase's book is The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. I'd like to ask you to read from a passage early in the book about how your identity abruptly changed and a newfound kind of liberation allowed you to go places you'd never been before.
Mm. Yeah, this is a tough one to read, actually. This whole chapter was actually pretty wild to write, but basically, my best friend over there got blown up in one of these bombings that we're hearing about. And he was at that time the police chief of Kabul. And I later learned online to be interior minister. So it was really devastating for the country as well as to all of his friends when this happened. And I just, you know, I went immediately over to his house where his body was, you know, awaiting burial, which happens very quickly in Islamic culture. And so I ended up going up to his village with the whole crowd. And so here's when we arrive at the village, which is about an hour to the north of Kandahar. The mud brick village blends in with the landscape. Our trucks pull up and park in rows. Child-sized table and bench sets have been dragged out of another schoolhouse and piled up against its walls. The packed earth yard inside is spread with carpets and seating mattresses. Tents are strung overhead for shade. Akram's brother waves me to a far corner. Obediently, I step out of my shoes and pick my way across the carpets. But I can't stay there a full minute. I can't stay there all by myself, apart from everyone. I skirt the mattresses on my way back to the first row, right by the compound door that everyone's entering through, and sit back down. I hear Akram's brother mutter something about completely in the way. I know it. I'm in the way. I'm an eyesore. I shouldn't be here at all, in fact. Women do not attend funerals in Afghanistan. I'm the only one and the only foreigner. I had thrown on charcoal gray hiking pants that morning, military looking, a blue and white striped man shirt and a white embroidered shawl to cover my hair. I watch the graybeards do their double take as they notice me and, distracted, stare. This isn't even Kandahar, this is Khakrez back in the hills, one of the most conservative villages in this conservative country, and by some miracle I've been allowed to come here to share this moment.
You know, you describe the kind of theatrical techniques that it takes to get access and to be amongst the people in Afghanistan. I mean, on one level, you participated in Ramadan, which bonded you extraordinarily with fighters early on, and it was something that came very natural to you. Yet also, you had to hide your gender. On other occasions.
Hide my gender in the sense that I wore Afghan men's clothes. It wasn't that I literally wanted to pretend to be a guy. It was that, at least from a distance, you know, I didn't
want
people...
It's all about not shocking, not showing off, not being extravagant, which is very Islamic.
And what's interesting is I actually have found that I end up kind of playing with that in two directions, because I'm extremely extravagant in the way that I interact with people, in the sense that I say stuff to people, to their faces, that no Afghan would ever dare to say.
Yeah, I don't think they call that extravagant. I think they call that pushy foreigner.
Pushy. I'm a big mouth. I was called in a recent review a professional big mouth. It was not a very nice review, but I actually kind of agree. And in a way, I've almost taken on that role semi-deliberately, because I feel that as a foreigner, ironically, in a lot of ways, I'm safer than Afghans. And so I can get away with challenging the power structure in ways that Afghans can't. And so I try to serve as their mouthpiece. And
Well, I want to explore this notion of are you safer than Afghans in a moment, but let's talk to Alice from Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you. I would call you forthright. I've been so interested, I've kind of forgotten what I call about. First of all, I say that we would like the same things they do there, you know, a chance to just be ourselves and take care of ourselves. I'm wondering if you... I feel that we should spend more money on the State Department diplomacy rather than the military. And what hope do you see for the future?
On the State Department and the military, I think that's a really excellent point, and it's something that I get into in this book, because it is very clear that our foreign policy is being conducted by the Department of Defense. And I think this is really an issue that we as American citizens need to think about really hard and decide if that's how we want it to be. And if it isn't, we have to do something to change it, you know.
And it's not as though the Department of Defense doesn't have their heart in the right place.
No.
You tell a story about reaching out to you to figure out what's going on the ground, and yet the message you tried to deliver being sort of lost in a kind of bureaucratic incompetence. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Yeah. Well, one of the main problems is the rotations. So at one point, the coalition commander, is this the time that you're talking about?
Right.
Got wind of some of the things that I was saying by a circuitous route and decided he wanted to talk to me. And so I went up to Kabul and spent 2 hours with him, and then he sent me down to his base commander in Kandahar, and I spent a couple hours with him, and the guy was great. And he was really flabbergasted by some of the things that I was telling him.
Talking about the sort of subtleties of tribal identities, the way that tribes interact, you know, the way you're looking at this is way more subtle than maybe the way you're actually dealing with it.
Yeah. What in particular had happened was the very same guy that the U.S. Special Forces had basically imposed on President Karzai as governor of the province became the one contact that the American military was working with in Kandahar, whereas he's only one tribe, represents one tribe out of like three main ones and maybe 10 altogether. And so the rest of the city was really feeling that the American army was basically the personal servants of this one tribe, and so everyone else was feeling quite resentful about this.
So they had you make up a bit of a Frommer's kind of cheat sheet guide of, Afghanistan with a map explaining some of these tribal loyalties and what happened to that.
That was 2.5 years after the fall of the Taliban. So that implies that the U.S. Army was never able to acquire that information in 2.5 years to begin
wow.
with. And then I gave this to the base commander a couple of months before he came into the theater. And then several months afterwards, he actually asked for the same document or the same information from one of his officers who contacted me. I said, my God, I gave this thing to him 6 months ago.
Wow.
So I think there's
and
a real
it reaching
problem.
Out, but a bad execution.
Bad execution, terrible transmission of knowledge from one rotation to the next.
Jack from Moline, Illinois, you're on the air. Jack.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I've been a fan of both of you guys, John and Sarah. You know, followed all your work. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Work,
yeah.
Both of you. And Sarah, I'm gonna lend you one of my guardian angels. You know, send you out to Afghanistan to watch over you.
I need it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing out is our greatest resource are just the needs and wishes and dreams of ordinary people. You know, we truly can turn everything on a dime. You know, even our effort in Iraq, it's just what we want to do. Do we want to make war or do we want to make peace? You know, Sarah, you're showing that making peace is risky. You know, making peace will get you killed. But you know, we're going to have something at the end of it. With this war, making war, we have nothing at the end. We still have to make peace after the war. So
I think that's the point. I think the point is we tend to have a kind of binary approach to some of these issues. And if I speak for myself personally, I personally opposed the Iraq war. Having lost that battle, you know, I mean, having that war having been launched, there was still a lot that the American public could have done to try to push our government to then perform in a different way than it did after the war. And I think that the peace piece has been really neglected. And in fact, I think there's a distinction that's made often by decision makers, which is to say, well, there's the security piece, which is one thing, and then the governance piece, which is something else. But what I've discovered in Afghanistan, and I think Iraq is the same, is that if you neglect governance, you're going to get insecurity. And so you have to start with governance at the very, very beginning.
And escalating insecurity means you can never get back to the governance. Right. Well, I want to thank Jack for calling, especially for his guardian angels, which kind of motivates me to want to say something like, you know, go to our website and leave a guardian angel for Sarah Chase. I bet we'll probably get 100,000 of those. David is calling from Washington, D.C. David, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, as a foreign servicer heading out to Afghanistan, I was happy to hear someone acknowledge the State Department role. But it seems to me that regardless of whatever aid programs we're trying to do, whether they be infrastructure-related or small kind of Grameen bank-type projects, none of them are going to succeed without security. And my question for Sarah would be what her perception is of the security environment there, whether the Taliban/Pashtun/Al-Qaeda opposition is really three distinct elements, if they're all merged together. To what extent, for instance, was this refusal of hospitality inspired by, you know, foreign elements that are perhaps having an influence on what would normally be Afghan culture and instituting something else?
Well, foreign elements, I don't see a lot of Al-Qaeda activity actually in Afghanistan, and I think that's been a big mistake that we've made over the last number of years, is that we've focused almost exclusively on Al-Qaeda terrorism, which has a kind of global agenda and is very ideological. The Taliban use the same vocabulary, but were really created by Pakistan with a very limited regional agenda. And that's what I think is still, and that's the reason why we kind of ignored them over the last 5 years. And it's come back to bite us, because I still think it's a regional agenda. I don't think the people who are fighting in Kandahar really are going to be planning any attacks in the United States. I think it's something that Pakistan primarily, with some other nations, neighboring countries is fomenting in order to try to maintain a degree of control over a country that it considers to be its strategic depth or its backyard or its junkyard. So it's really bad, actually. But the other piece of that is the governance piece, because if, let me tell you that if this Afghan population were happy with its government, it would not, there would not be a single Talib who could cross the border. The fact is that the ordinary people, and this goes back to the previous caller, the ordinary people at this point literally see the government and the Taliban as being two warring factions, and they are outside of it. I know a district chief of Panjwahi district where there's been intense fighting in the last couple of days. Sorry, the chief of the district council. He brought together the elders of the district, and they decided that they would offer the Taliban the following deal, which is, we will empty a village for you. If you want to fight with the government, that's your business. You're welcome to it. We don't want anything to do with it. We will empty a village for you, and you can use that as your battlefield. Just stay away from us.
Wow. That's interesting. David, you say your State Department?
Yes.
What do you hope to achieve going to? What's your mission?
Well, I don't want to be too self-identifying, but I would be involved in economic issues.
I see.
And, actually, if I could ask a follow-up question, one of the things that we've heard is that the carpet industry in Afghanistan, or industry, if you can even use that word, is kind of being put at a disadvantage because the carpets have to be finished in Pakistan, and then they get exported from Pakistan. That's where all the money goes. And
everything follows that pattern.
That's interesting. David, thank you very much for calling. That is a fascinating.
Yeah.
How does that impact on your soap business?
I mean, it's not impacting us directly, but I'm a member of the manufacturers union, and one thing that I discovered through our meetings is that the customs regime, for example, had a double as high a customs tariff on raw materials coming into Afghanistan as on manufactured goods. It's literally the opposite of most protectionist regimes. So you were penalized. There were members of our union who were literally penalized for trying to open factories in Afghanistan because they would have a higher customs barrier on their raw materials.
That's very interesting.
And I would say, you know, I mean, I've been in a struggle with a USAID-funded, that's the Agency for International Government,
International Development,
yep, that's part of the State Department. We're talking about trying to inject money into the Afghan economy to make it work. It took me, you know, it took me a year of negotiation to try to get any startup support for the work that we're doing, which is manufacturing licit products that use licit agriculture.
Right.
So it's a kind of anti-opium project. It's really hard to get that money out onto the ground.
One question, we don't have time to go to her now, wanted to know how the poppy crop is doing.
Poppy crop is, it's exploding. It's a totally integrated part of the economy.
Destabilizing?
Destabilizing. In some ways, it's stabilizing because it keeps people in villages because they have something to eat and it was, you know, something to sell. But it's destabilizing the political situation because political decisions are starting to be made according to the interests of the drug industry.
So your friend John from Moline, you know, wants a guardian angel for you. You suggested that you were somehow safer than people in Afghanistan. I'm wondering how realistic that is.
I'm safer from what the government could do to me. I don't think the government would. I mean, government officials have private prisons where people have unpleasant things done to them and things like that. People can be beaten on the street. I've seen a rickshaw, which is a little three-wheeled taxi vehicle, get its back lights kicked out because it paused in front of a soldier's area.
And your immunity from that kind of abuse comes from what?
Comes from being American, actually. It comes from being a foreigner. I suspect that people don't really know what I am. And my joke is that some people may think I've got a predator flying around over my head, you know, and I don't necessarily...
disabuse them of that.
That's right.
Mythology.
That's right. And so far, I also believe that most of the violent activity, as I keep on saying, although the space is being created by Afghan disillusionment, most of the violent activity is being inspired by Pakistan. And I think that Pakistan also has an interest in maintaining a relationship with the United States.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book title is The Punishment of Virtue. I can barely imagine a reward for the virtues of your presence in Afghanistan. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Sarah Chase, author of The Punishment of Virtue. I'm John Hockenberry, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.